May the words of my mouth and the thoughts of my heart be acceptable before you, O God, my rock and my redeemer. And now, for the official opening and disclaimer for this class. Shalom all and welcome. I am your host, Ariel Bar-Tzedok. You find me online at koshertorah.com. I've entitled this course, An Orthodox Rabbi Reads the Christian Bible. My purpose and intent in teaching this course is simple. I want to be able to explain why Torah Judaism and Torah faithful Jews do not and will not accept or embrace the teachings of the Christian religion. I have no intentions or desire in this course to attack the religion of Christianity. I am not here to challenge or critique those who embrace the Christian faith. I am not here to talk about Christianity at all. Even though due to the nature of this material, I am sure that I will not be able to avoid the topic entirely. Nevertheless, I am here to look at the Christian Bible from an entirely Torah point of view. I begin with certain premises. I do not deny the existence of an historical Yeshu, be he called Yeshua or what. For Torah faithful Jews, Yeshu was not, is not, and can never be the Messiah of Israel. For Torah faithful Jews, Yeshu was not, is not, and can never be God, or even a son of God, any more than any other human being of flesh and blood. For the record, the historical Yeshu was born, lived as, and died as a Jew. He and his original followers were all Jews, who, like him, were born, lived as, and died as Jews. Absolutely none of them were Christians, in any sense of the word. We Torah faithful Jews follow the same religion that Yeshua himself practiced. We pray to the same Heavenly Father. We live by the same Torah, mitzvot, and ma'asim tovim. Yeshua is not a Christian, and neither are we. Yeshua's original followers were all Torah-observant Jews, as was he. As Jews, educated in Torah, drenched in its teachings, and from what can be seen, knowing no other spiritual path, I must logically conclude that the original writings of Yeshua's original followers were all Jewish writings, and therefore well within my domain as a Torah-observant rabbi to read them and understand them as would one rabbi to another. I therefore begin with the position that anything found in the Christian Bible attributed to any of its Jewish authors that does not agree with Torah Judaism must not have been written by such an author and is therefore subject to suspicion and must be critically analyzed. And that is what I am here to do. Like many Torah sages before me, I do not accept the Talmudic Midrash about Yeshua at face value. Those teachings were meant to be polemic, not historical. Therefore, they will not be part of our discussions. I've been led to perform this work because of the experiences in my personal life. As a teenager, I was victimized by a terrible evangelical group in my hometown on Long Island. This group was led by a very evil, lying, deceitful individual who turned out to also be a pedophile. I am thankful that I was able to escape being victimized in that way. Nevertheless, this individual sought to clandestinely place his minions in Orthodox yeshivot in Israel to get them to learn about Judaism with the attempt to make it easier for them to persuade Jews to convert and join their fold. I fought long and hard against this group, and I'm proud of my contributions in thwarting their efforts. It was through them and because of them that I became exposed to Christianity, and have therefore devoted the last 40 years of my life to study and investigation to discover whatever of the truth that is still out there to be discovered. Now, after 40 years, I feel confident and ready to share my insights and discoveries with you. So again, I reiterate, I am not here to attack our God-fearing, Christian, Bible-believing neighbors. I hold them in the highest esteem and respect. I am here to explain to you and to them, and to all willing to listen, what we Torah faithful Jews see when we read the Christian Bible, and why we see what we do. And now, let us proceed with tonight's lesson. We're in lesson 8 of this series right now. We're in chapter 9 of the book of Matthew. For no special reason, I'm pretty much just going through Matthew and the sequences here. And as I do, as I've reiterated in past lessons, I endeavor always to read the Christian commentaries to see what they are saying about what's written here. And it is amazing that I find two things over and over again. Number one, there's clearly a denial on the part of Christian commentators to address the political and militant issue of Yeshu's movement. Those that do comment on it usually dismiss it right away and proclaim in such a loud voice how Yeshu was the, in quote, Prince of Peace, and how his movement was pacifistic, and those who don't agree with that image are not true Christians, and yada, yada, yada. Very few Christians come across with the true history, like Professor Brandon from Manchester University in his book Jesus and the Zealots and others, and there are others out there. The second thing which I find most uncomfortable is that regardless of whatever I hear proclaimed, I am more and more convinced as I go through this material of the indelible, undeniable, and very possibly unremovable strain of anti-Semitism that runs through Christian theology. Needless to say, this did not come from Yeshu himself. We have other issues with Yeshu the historical man. Anti-Semitism was not one of them. Apparently, whenever Christians come to discuss anything about Jews or Judaism, they just can't. I mean, are there exceptions? Yes. But there are so few from the rule that it's disappointing. It really is just shame. Because as we're reading Yeshu's words here and Yeshu's stories and putting it clearly in a Jewish context, we are seeing something so radically different from what the religion of Christianity has forever been portraying. Now, I am no scholar with regards to the historical development of the Christian Bible. In my premise, as you know, if these or of these books that were written by Jews, bottom line, in these days, they did not have the internet. They did not have access and exposure to the countless different religious philosophies and systems the likes of a Jew would find in Rome. Maybe the Roman Jewish community did, but not in Israel, especially in the Galilee. These were simple folk who were learned through oral tradition and were very zealous for their own nation and culture. This is historically verified by the likes of Josephus and others. They wouldn't have tolerated the interaction of different philosophical beliefs. They were Jews through and through. So was Yeshu. And in that respect, if Matthew the Jew really wrote this book, then he's writing it from a Jewish point of view. And anything in there that's not Jewish within the context of Judaism as a religion in that day, he couldn't have written. So then, how could such things get here? Well, this is what I said is suspicious and needs to be analyzed critically. And again, I turn to the Christian scholars. They're the ones who educate me and show me what I've long suspected. And that is that things aren't as black and white as the Christian faithful might think. You will hear a Christian term called the gospel truth. As the word says, and that's it. Well, no, that's not it. And anyone who's a scholar, Jewish or Christian for that matter, knows that. But the rank and file simply do not. And that, unfortunately, is the problem. You see, as you all know, faith is not an issue of logic or rationale. We have faith in what we believe. We believe what we want to believe. We believe what we are emotionally convinced to believe, whether it's because of our ethnic upbringing, our cultural background, and in all due respect, Jews and Judaism, same psychological principle applies to everyone else. No difference here. But yet, to think, to go out, to explore. That's not something most are willing to do. And why I have found that many of that persuasion are upset with my approach to teaching this material. And in that respect, I apologize. As you know, I don't wish to offend and insult anyone. But psychologically speaking, we must remember all religions, all of them, including Judaism, is what we call a myth. Now, a myth does not mean a make-believe story with no historical foundation, but rather, it means the psychological model which the individual mind embraces and accepts as its outlook on the world. And the Christian outlook is what it is, and history doesn't play into this. They have their role and idea. Their Jesus, of course, we all know, is either Norwegian, German, or Swede. He is blonde-haired and blue-eyed and very, almost effeminate in nature. Yada, yada, on and on. That's every portrayal, and you all know it. And we all know how historically inaccurate that is, but people don't want to hear. And that's why in these classes, I'm trying to perform an act of tikkun, if you will. The Hebrew word tikkun means rectification. I want people to understand that of Yeshu, or that which of Yeshu, is Jewish. Why? So as to make Yeshu more palatable to Jews? No. Rather, to make Judaism and Jewish teachings more palatable to Christians. I assure you, there are millions of good Christian people out there who truly are in the right place and frame of mind and frame of heart and are great people. I consider some of them closer brothers and sisters than I can consider certain wayward Jews of my own people. That's for sure. But I'm not here to discuss politics. I want to now focus on our text here. And what we're going to cover first, of course, is the issues of miracles. And again, we're going to look into and see insights into the entire Judaic context. And then, as the title of this class, Yeshu the Zealot Prepares for War. In this lessons here, you will clearly see, if you have the eye to see, if you're willing to be honest and look into the text honestly, you will clearly see the underlying message here, which even however many later editors of the Gentile church could not edit out. Maybe they didn't know, maybe they didn't see it, but from a Jewish eye we see. And that's what we're here to look at. Chapter 9. I believe, according to my records here, we left off with verse 16. Yeshu is giving here something called the parable of cloth and bottles. No man puts a piece of new cloth onto an old garment, for that which is put in to fill it up takes from the garment and renders even made worse. Neither do men put new wine in old bottles, else the bottle breaks and the wine runneth out, and the bottle perishes. But they put new wine into new bottles, and both are preserved. Now, this whole thing about new wine and new bottles, that's almost a verbatim quote from Rebbe Meir that we find right in Pirkei Avot. What is this teaching? Well, from the traditional Christian point of view, they would say, well, the new wine, which has to go into the new bottles, of course, is the gospel of Yeshu into the New Testament. And it's a subtle message here that Yeshu is casting aside Judaism and teaching Christianity. That's what all the commentators say. But there's only one big problem with this. Yeshu didn't say that. Yeshu was not a Christian. Yeshu was a Jew. And for that matter, he's a rather radical, right-wing, ultra-Orthodox Jew of his day. So, if from our Yeshu's, I should say, point of view of ultra-Orthodoxy, what is he talking about? That's how you have to look at this. He's certainly not talking about Christianity. But maybe he is echoing the same teachings as Rabbi Meir in Pirkei Avot. Because bottom line, if you're using the same aphorism, using the same slogans, you're using the same words, then maybe there's some kind of a similar content. Now, you have to understand, in the days of Yeshu, temple still stood, the generation after Hillel and Shammai, this is the famous period of what we call the Talmudic teachers, the Mishnaic teachers called the Tanaim. All right, this is the time of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and many of the great Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, many of the great Talmudic minds. They're all contemporaries. There is no reason to think that somehow, in some way, in some unrecorded history, that maybe Yeshu bumped into, dialogued with Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Shimon. They very well, under the circumstances, might have crossed paths. It would have been interesting to know what they thought of one another. Because I suspect that maybe there was, at some way, at a time, mutual respect. Because up until now, we don't really see Yeshu doing anything rather radical. He is clearly starting a political messianic movement for the insurrection against the Roman government. That is clear, and it's going to become clearer as we move on here. He is doing this how? Well, you must understand messianism in this time period. Unlike today, where a messianic character is expected to be a politician, a rabbi politician, similar to maybe a Rabbi Meir Kahane in his day. People always considered him to be in the messianic spirit. Well, in the first century, we had many, many miracle workers. What would today we would call Kabbalists. They were Pharisees, they were Essenes. These are people who not only talked to the angels, but walked with them as well. They knew powers of healing. They had powers of tremendous deeds. We've discussed this in the past. Men of such character and renown are with us in this very generation who do these kinds of things. That is why when Jews come to read the stories of miracles and all that, we don't say, well, this is God, because no one else can do it. On the contrary, we say, well, yeah, a lot of people can do it. Because even as Yeshu himself says, that power can be given to men. And those who are righteous and who walk with God, that's what happens. So, what then is Yeshu talking about? Well, if you want to call the nation to rise up and follow you militarily, against an insurmountable military giant, Rome, you're going to have to convince the people that you are some supernatural, super powerful Rebbe. They believed in those days that the Mashiach to come would be an incarnation, a reincarnation of, if you would, the Archangel Metatron. Now, I have written about this. Go on to koshertorah.com, look up an essay I wrote called The Secret Soul of the Messiah, and it's all there. This is what they believed. Whether or not it was true is irrelevant. But if Yeshu or anyone else is going to prove himself to be the Messiah, well then, he had to cultivate a reputation for himself. And therefore, he had to do all these kinds of things. So you'll notice, he's telling people, he goes out publicly and heals everybody to start all the conversation and the hubbub. Then he tells people, don't tell anybody, but it's a psychological ploy, they go out and do it anyway. It builds up a reputation of awe. Here comes the Rebbe. And again, it's not too dissimilar from modern day Hasidim and how they show awe and respect, whether or however sincere or not, another story, to their rebbes. This is the way it is. So Yeshu had a mission to create for himself a reputation. Clearly, many of his teachings are indicative of ascetic teachings and practices. But yet, the matter of healing and things like that. Good question. The new wine is this new focus of sacrifice. You see, this was the major schism between the historical Yeshua and our rabbis. Our rabbis were made aware of what you could call the Holy Spirit, Ruach HaKodesh, that the temple was in danger, and that if the zealots did take over and start a war with Rome, that indeed they would lose and there would be a Holocaust. And they went to every extreme to try to avoid that. And the Talmud is replete with all the legends and stories about this. Yeshu's group, like the Essenes, like the Zealots, chose to push the envelope and said, let's just throw caution to the wind and fight. That was the major disagreement. We find echoes of this in the story of the Biryonim, the Zealots, who took over Jerusalem. And we read about this in Tractate Gittin in the Talmud, and the Legends of the Talmud series in Kosher Torah. We have this whole story outlined. Please go there for more information. But now, just to get through this here, to move on. He says two miracles of healing. While he spoke about these things, there came a certain ruler, right, and worshipped him. Nobody is worshipping anybody here. The fact that this King James version that I'm reading says that, I don't know what the original Greek says. Certainly, Matthew, the Jew, would never have said that. But a Christian reading that would expect it, because he's God and he's supposed to worship God, and they don't see this. We have to. He says, my daughter is even now dead. Come, lay your hand on her and she shall live. So it says, Yeshu rose and followed him, and so did his disciples. Now listen to this. Behold, a woman was diseased with an issue of blood for 12 years. What do we call that? Nida, zava. Right? And it says she came behind him and touched the hem of his garment. I would love to see the original word. I'm sure that must have been his tzitzit. We read in another place that another woman touches the fringe of his garment. Yeshu, like every other Jew of the time, wore a talit with the tzitzit outside, very much unlike tradition for Sephardim today, but we don't follow Minhag Yeshu, what can I say? And yet, why from behind? Apparently she's a sanua woman. Right? She said, if I could touch his garments, I'll be whole. Right? That's the kind of emunah, faith, that you see in people to this very day. Want an example? I'm going to give you a very relevant modern example. Do you think today that great and holy Kabbalists allow women to kiss them? Well, yes, they do. No, not kissing on the lips or anything weird or perverted, please. But Rav Kaduri, the great holy Kabbalist who did not speak of Yeshu in spite of this ridiculous book that's out there now. I spoke with Rav Kaduri personally about Yeshu, and he certainly was no believer in him. He would allow women to come and kiss his hand. Why? Because he was of the opinion that the hand, when a woman comes to kiss the hand of the ancient rabbi, this is not a flirtatious act. It's an act of awe and respect. And people would come to kiss the Rav's hand, and miracles did happen. Yes, they do. Because they believe. They have faith. And, like the Talmud says, the entire Torah is summed up in that single commandment that the righteous live by faith. Faith transforms things. And this woman, this Jewish woman, touches his tzitzit. He turns around, he sees her, and he says, daughter, be of good comfort. Your faith has made you whole. Notice he did not say, I have healed you. Notice he did not say, God has healed you. He says, your faith. Yeshu apparently was pretty savvy in psychology and recognized the power of archetype. that when you approach the Rebbe, people really get overwhelmed. They really get psyched up. And they believe that by being in contact with the presence with the Rebbe, whether it's Yeshua in his day or modern rabbis today, that somehow, somewhere, their prayers will be answered. And indeed, that is psychologically true. What can I say? And Yeshua called it right. He didn't say, I made you whole, God made you. He said, your faith, power of faith. Who disagrees? Not the Talmud, that's for sure. Moving right along. Yeshua now comes to this ruler's house. He sees the minstrels and the people making the noise. What are minstrels and people making noise for? These were the professional mourners. That's how it was in those days, okay? So he says to them, all right, give place. The maid is not dead but sleepeth. And they laughed him to scorn. Now, did he go in? Says, when the people were put forth, he went in, took her by the hand, and she arose. And his fame went throughout all the land. Was this gal really dead? Was she in a coma? Was she ill? I don't know. Is this story even a historical event or legend? I don't know. But the Essenes, as Josephus records, were renowned for their secret abilities of profound healing. So, if Yeshu does have an Essenic background, even though the story doesn't record it, maybe he had some herbs or something else with him. Maybe he knew some type of energy work, which the rabbis to this day still know. Maybe he knew some ancient Essenic form similar to acupuncture or acupressure. All of that is legitimate bioenergetic science. You got thousands of verifiable medical evidential reports coming out of China today that prove it, in spite of whatever Western medicine says. Well, in those days, ancient Israelite medicine, Chinese medicine, pretty similar. But you should have known these things. Cool and groovy. Baal Shem Tov was renowned as a healer, founder of the modern Hasidic movement. So that the Rebbe Yeshua could do this? Cool and groovy. Okay? No indication that he's God. It didn't say he resurrected the dead. No, you don't see those words here. He healed her. Good for him. Good for her. Moving right along. When Yeshua departed thence, two blind men followed him, crying out, saying, Oh, Son of David, have mercy on us. Why is he called the Son of David? Again, the rumors that he is of the royal bloodline. Because who other than the royal bloodline can claim the throne? Remember, this is political. All about the reestablishment of the Jewish-Israelite monarchy. Bottom line, you have to be of the bloodline. That is why, for example, however much illusions of grandeur you or I would want to have about delusional that we're Messiah, how can we be Messiah if we're not in the house of David? Oh, but I am. Oh, really? You are? Prove it. Just like today, somebody who comes and says, I'm Jewish, that has to be verified in a court, in a bet din. You're the house of David, equally has to be verified. Maybe Yeshua had that verification in his bloodline. I don't know. There's always been questions and issues with regards to his daddy. But if the genealogies, remember we covered the genealogies in our earlier classes, they contradict one another. We don't know which way to go with this. So there's problems there. But a reputation goes before you. I don't know how many of the common folk are really trying to look at his genealogy. Bottom line, if you can create an army and people follow you, I don't think they're all going to be lining up and saying, we see your genealogy, please. So, if they believe he's a Ben David, then he is. So you got these blind men going out. He says he comes to the house, the blind men come, and Yeshua says, do you believe ye that I am able to do this? And they said, yea, Lord? Lord as if it's a God name? No, Rabbani. Rebbe, teacher, master, teacher of a title of respect. He says, he touches their eyes, he says, according to your faith, not according to me, He doesn't say, I heal you in the name of the Lord. Lordy, lordy. No. Faith makes you whole. Again, a Jewish concept right out of the Talmud, Tractate Makot 24a. What every Rebbe in Yerushalayim will tell you to this very day, you have to have emunah, faith. So it says their eyes were opened. How did he open them? Did he use any kind of herb or anything, a salve or something? We don't know. Text doesn't say. The text is not here to enumerate those things, so we will never know. It says their eyes were opened, and Yeshu straightly charged them, see that no man know it. Why would he not want it known that he could do this? He just raised up this girl, right, in front of everybody. Why here is secret? Again, you see the reverse psychology here? If I go and I come to you and I do some like super zowie stuff, right? If any of you are like 200 pounds overweight and I do my hocus pocus Kabbalah, you turn around three times and stand on your head and poof! 200 pounds fall off, and all of a sudden, you're a woman, you're in a dress size 6, you're a guy, you're in a pants waist size 30. Wow, miracle! And I tell you, don't tell anybody. You'll nod your head, yes, yes, Rebbe, I won't tell anybody. Next thing I know, it's all over YouTube, all over the internet. Hey, now people are, reverse psychology. You see it here. Moving right along. As it says here, when they departed, spread abroad his fame in all that country. And they went out, behold, they brought him a dumb man possessed with a devil. Woo-hoo. Psychological imbalance, the likes of which we discussed in our previous lessons. So when the devil was cast out and the dumb guy spoke, the multitudes marveled, saying it was never seen so in Israel. But that's not true. Because we see this all the time in Israel. Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa. All right. Honi Ma'agel. Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanos, Rabbi Ishmael, right? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. These are all contemporaries. We have stories about them too. And now it says like this. This is curious. But the Pharisees said, he casts out devils through the prince of the devils. And I sat and I questioned, what the heck does that mean? They're saying that he casts out the demons by conjuring up a bigger demon? That's weird. That's strange. It doesn't make any sense when you think about it. There is no Jewish context. There is no Jewish concept. Jewish knowledge of demonology is very, very involved. We have full books. Remember King Solomon knew all about those demons and stuff? We read about it in the Talmud. Again, I have lessons on that in the Legends of the Talmud series. The entire, in quote, Testament of Solomon, the Christian book, is all about that stuff. Solomon knew. Well, that knowledge has always been passed down in Jewish circles to this very day. To this very day, you can read about things like this in the Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch, which we covered in the Laws of the Occult series. Again, on Kosher Torah, go learn about it. So to say that, cast out devils with the prince of devils makes no sense, right? It's almost like a grammatical sentence that doesn't fit grammatically. And so I sat here and I said, what would that mean? And it dawned on me. It dawned on me. How many people get involved with things like exorcisms and all this stuff when indeed there's no real demons or dibukim there in the first place? But we're dealing with psychological stuff. I would think that maybe some of the rabbis, this is my understanding of this, that maybe some of the rabbis of the day who, if they heard all these stories about him in quote, releasing the devils, they themselves knowing that there was no real dibuk, no shed, no real demon, but psychological problems, would have said something, oh yeah, he's really releasing the demons. Wink, wink. In other words, yeah, okay. You know, if that's what you want to believe kind of thing. That would make sense. That they would doubt that this is something supernatural. I get that. Even in the last generation, 20th century, we had the great Rabbi Yehuda Fatiha, who wrote the whole book about his interactions with spirits and everything else. And I remember one great Kabbalist, I think he's still alive, he said to me once, and I won't repeat his name because I don't want to embarrass him. He probably won't admit saying this now. But he said to me, and he knew Rabbi Fatiha personally, not everybody agreed with Rabbi Fatiha that he was experiencing the reality of all these spirits. Some people thought it was all in his head. Who am I to judge? I can only tell you what was told me. So, judging from how some people look at people involved with spirits today, probably they thought the same thing in those days. Moving right along. Listen to what comes next. Yeshua went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and preaching the gospel of the kingdom, healing every sickness and every disease among the people. Healing again. What is the gospel of the kingdom? Well, Christians will say, the crucifixion, the resurrection, you got to be able to be Yeshua for your sins, yada, yada. All of this stuff which makes no Jewish sense whatsoever. There is no concept of a fall that requires grace in Judaism. There's no concept of eternal damnation. There is no concept of needing a salvation. There's no concept of any of this. So to say that's the gospel of the kingdom, that might be a Christian understanding, but Yeshua was not a Christian. Yeshua was a Jew. What then was the, in quote, gospel, good news of the kingdom? Which kingdom? Not the kingdom up in heaven that comes in the afterlife. The kingdom on the earth. The restoration of the Davidic monarchy. The good news would be very similar if today Rabbi Kahane was alive and he went from synagogue to synagogue saying, we have people of the Davidic bloodline. We have a guy here, he's of the Davidic bloodline, he can reconstitute the Jewish monarchy, we're going to have to overthrow the government of the state of Israel, put Bibi out of a job, we're going to take over the Knesset, we're going to reconstitute the government and establish a Torah monarchy. You can imagine how that would go over in modern day Israel. Well, that's pretty much how it went over back in ancient day Israel too. What is this talk? You go on to all the religious websites, read the religious newspapers, look at the conflict in modern day Israel, wherein which the religious have become so entrenched that they're trying to enforce and impose a Torah state, a Torah Taliban state, upon the entire country. Thank God we don't have a singular leader who would be interpreted to be a Messiah. But there would be major social upheavals in Israel today. That was the message, the good news of the kingdom, that the insurrection was coming. That which the people longed for, craved for, desired, that they're willing in their faith to push everything. Moving right along. It says here, when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion on them because they fainted, they were scattered abroad as sheep having no shepherd. Those are the people you want to get as followers. They don't ascribe to any Rebbe, and there's no competition. You gather them like sheep. I don't know. Is being sheep a good thing? You know how we say sheep, right? Sheep are the ones who don't know how to think for themselves. They're easily taken advantage of. I'm not sure that this reference to sheep is a positive reference at all. So then he says to his disciples, the harvest truly is plenteous, but the laborers are few. In other words, you can see him saying, bingo, the people are ready for the message. Let's gather the army. Again, he's preparing for war. Pray ye therefore that the Lord of the harvest, that he sends forth laborers into the harvest. He's saying, pray that we get enough people who are going to go out there and raise up an army. One of the great problems that the United States military had in their invasion in either Iraq or Afghanistan especially was, needless to say, an entire population of people who are antagonized by their presence and who viewed them as the enemy. Same thing as it was in Vietnam. And it was in all of these places that the popular support caused all the trouble. Yeshu, almost like a modern-day Taliban leader or a modern-day AQ leader, recognizes, go among the people. And the more and more that the foreigner oppresses, the more and more they hate you, the more the people are ready to become our silent supporters. Chapter 10. So, he says, and when he called unto them his 12 disciples, it says here he gave them power against unclean spirits to cast them out and heal all manners of sickness and all manner of disease. What kind of power does he give them? Well, the power of the Son of God. Well, wait a second. According to the Christian theology, all this Son of God power only came after the crucifixion. He ain't been crucified yet. So he's still a human being yet. Where did the power come from? From God. Yeah, I get that it comes from God. Jewish rabbis have this power all the time. So the power essentially doesn't come from Yeshu unless he was a Rebbe who opened up the books, if you will. At that time, they were mostly oral, and taught them specific ascetic instructions about how to do these things. I know how to perform exorcisms. Do them a lot. I know all different things about healings. Go read the stuff that I put up on koshertorah.com. It's all there. Now, if any of you wanted to learn this from me, well, today, with modern tech, I just send you to the internet, to koshertorah.com. But let's say we existed like in Yeshu's day. There was no internet. My goodness, can you imagine such a time? Well, the books weren't even written. So you'd have the oral traditions and you'd pass it on. I get that too. And the more and more you got teachers out there who can do the stuff that impress people, the more and more you create the power of faith, belief, and trust. And that's how you build an army. So, listen to this. Now the names of the 12 apostles, right? The Shelichim, the messengers. First is Simon, who was called Peter, Andrew his brother, James the son of Zebedee, and John his brother. Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector, James the son of Alphaeus, Lebbaeus, whose surname is Thaddeus. And listen to these guys. In verse 4 of chapter 10 in the King James Version, it speaks of Simon the Canaanite and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him. Bingo, 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 bingo! Everything I've been telling you right here. Number one, there were no Canaanites then. Canaanite is not the correct translation. The word was Kanai. All right, my Hebrew scholars out there, what's a Kanai? How do we translate that today? You know it. A zealot. One of his top 12 was clearly called by name a member of the political party known as the Kanaim, the zealots. Coincidence. Oh, really? The Torah says that you need two witnesses to prove something. Well, here's witness number two. Mr. Yehuda. Judah is called Iscariot. Do you know what that means? Iscariot. It's Greek for the Aramaic word sikari. You know what a sikar was? A sikar is this little itsy-bitsy thin dagger. What these assassins used to do in olden time. Whenever there was in the Beit HaMikdash, they would put up the talitot to do the Birkanim. These guys would come up from behind, and they would take like a pike, like a sikar. They would stab it right up into the back of the neck, right underneath the knot tefillin, splitting the brain stem, causing instantaneous death. People don't even live long enough to scream. They were ninjas of the day, the sikari. They were also known, these zealots, and the sikari, the assassins. They were also known by the Talmudic name, the Birionim. We read about them again, Legends of the Talmud. Two of Yeshu's top 12. One is a renowned, a known assassin, and the other a known political agitator. What does that tell you who he's hanging out with? You notice they changed that? Canaanite. Who would think? Iscariot. Who would know? Someone who knows the truth. Here it is, black and white. So all this talk about me showing you, I see here subtly in the text he's building an army. And here you go, more hints. They ain't so subtle either. What does he say next? The 12, Yeshu sends forth and says, go not in the way of the Gentiles, and to the city of the Samaritans enter ye not. What? Let's put it into a modern derogatory term the way Yeshu would have meant it. Don't go to the Goyim. They're not our soldiers. You go only, he says, but rather go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Go to them. What's your message? Preach saying the kingdom of heaven is at hand. God's kingdom is coming back. We are poised to create an insurrection against the Roman government, to reestablish a Jewish monarchy, and heaven help those Jewish fellows of ours who don't join the revolution. Just like we read in Tractate Gittin, what happened? Listen to this. Let me read this to you and I'll explain. It says here, what do? You got to get him on your side. Heal the sick, clear the leper, raise the dead, cast out devils. And I'm going to skip for a second here. And he says here, verily at the end, all right, you go where it says peace and whoever doesn't receive you, etc. and so on, will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city. Now, I'm going to go back in just a second. You see, Yeshua was saying, you go out and you make sure people are going to listen. And if they don't, heaven help them. Proof? Tractate Gittin. When the zealots, the Birionim, took control of Jerusalem, the people of the city did not want to fight. They knew they couldn't win against Rome. They had enough provisions in the city to last a 20-year siege. And the people were not going to go out and fight. They said, we'll wait this out, we'll make peace. So what did these zealots do? They gathered all the supplies from every place in the entire city and they burned everything. Forcing a famine, saying to the people, you're either going to go out and fight or you can die. Well, guess what? They all ended up dying. That's the mentality that you see right here. So he says to them, this is actually very ascetic. He says, don't take a scrip for your journey, neither two coats, neither shoes, nor staff, for the workman is worthy of his meat. In other words, you're going out, and this is the ascetic way. They all went out poor. They went out with nothing. That showed a political statement that you're in it for sincere reasons as opposed to trying to make money out of it. So that's what they did. And he goes, into whatever city or town you enter, inquire who it is that's worthy, and there abide till ye go. They had to stay at the home of people who were appropriately, politically, and religiously aligned with them. All right? They were building connections, associations. They were building an army. And it says, and when you come to the town, to the house, salute it. And if the house be worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if not be worthy, let your peace return to you. Shalom. You bid them shalom. They give you shalom. Good. If not, this is just like the laws of war if you go back to the Torah. It says, when you go out to war, you call out to a town and you say, be with us in peace. If they say, then you destroy them. Pretty much the same mentality. So whoever shall not receive you nor hear your words when you depart out of that house, shake the dust off your feet. Mark it on your list. These are traitors to the Jewish monarchical cause. And when the king takes his rightful throne, you will remember your political enemies. That was their mentality. That's not a prince of peace talking. That's not a pacifist talking. That's somebody who's got a political agenda. And I might add, if you go into the book of Luke, chapter 19, verse 27, Yeshu clearly says, Bring my enemies and slaughter them at my feet. Not very nice. Moving right along. He says here, behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be therefore wise as serpent, but harmless or innocent as doves. Okay? He's telling people, you be careful now. You don't show up too much. You have to still remain clandestine. And what happens if you're discovered? What happens if you're discovered in a state of treason against the government, trying to create insurrection? Well, beware of men, for they will deliver you to the councils. They will scourge you in the synagogues. Why? Well, you're trying to create a civil war, which is going to lead to the deaths of, what happened was, million. And therefore, the leadership and the authorities. Think about today. If you had a messianic movement in Israel trying to overthrow the Israeli government, and they started to go into synagogues, what do you think is going to happen? The police are going to come and they're going to arrest the lunatics. It doesn't make any other sense. What is Yeshu talking about that would get people so upset that they're going to deliver you? And you shall be brought before governors and kings for my sake, for a testimony against them and the Gentiles. Where's the Gentile? What's all this Gentile stuff coming in again? Who are these governors and kings? I think that might have been a later addition to the text. But Yeshu is clearly warning his people. If you get caught, this is going to be trouble. So, when they deliver you up, don't think about how or what you're going to speak. You'll know what to say when the hour comes. Alright? She will not be you that speaks, it will be the spirit of your father which speaks in you. He says, what you're doing is God's work. To resurrect, to reconstitute the Jewish monarchy. If you get busted by the authorities doing this in your active insurgency against the government, don't worry about how you'll defend yourself. God will be with you. And the brother shall deliver up a brother to death, and the father the child, and the children shall raise up against their parent, cause them to be put to death. Why? And ye shall be hated of all men for, in quote, my name's sake. Why? Because you're trying to save people from their sins? Because you have a pacifist attitude? Because you're doing all these miracles? No! What's going to tick people off? If you are involved with terrorism, which is what insurrection against the government is, bottom line, you are a public threat. You are a criminal. And therefore, you are subject to arrest, prosecution, trial, punishment. By all means, every family can have lunatics who are these zealot Sicarii types. Shimon, Judah, Oh, not Yeshu. No, of course not. Yeah. This is what his warning was to them. You might get caught, you might get exposed. Very similar today, whether it was like the Viet Cong. Well, not today, but in the last generation, last century. The Viet Cong in Vietnam would go and infiltrate throughout Vietnam. If and when they were ever caught, you knew what happened to them. Like AQ, Al-Qaeda, or the Taliban, going in throughout places like Afghanistan and the rest, trying to cultivate support amongst the people. And if you dare show sympathy to the, in today's circumstance, American government, to the Afghanistan government, they kill you. Well, these are the kind of people Yeshu's followers were in his day. And you can imagine that this message, was not warmly embraced by everybody, but very clearly and evidently rejected by the majority. That's what he's saying. Then it says here, but you who endure the end shall be saved. I can't believe those words. Saved from what? It's not Jewish. So he says, when they persecute you in this city, flee yet to another. But verily I say unto you, you shall not have gone over all the cities of Israel until the Son of Man come. Son of Man, meaning, if you will, a messianic context. In other words, if you have to go from city to city to create the army, don't worry. Because by the time you get through all the cities in the country, the army will have been risen, the insurrection will have occurred, The revolution will have been successful. That's how imminent they were expecting it. They were expecting their civil war to be successful. Nothing to do here with any piney-eyed kingdom of heaven, afterlife, saved from hell, all this other kind of stuff. It doesn't fit. And if that is what Yeshua meant, like the Christians say, well, you shall not have gone over the cities of Israel till the Son of Man come, is false. Was the Son of Man in the Christian context, this means the, if you will, their concept of second coming. Well, I think everybody ran out of cities of Israel. They weren't expecting 2,000 years to go by. So there's proof of the inaccuracy of that. Moving right along. It says here, the disciple is not above his master, nor the servant above his Lord. It is enough for the disciple that he be as his master, and the servant as his Lord. If they have called the master of the house Beelzebub, how much more shall they call them of his household? So in other words, well, let's read the next verse here. Fear them not therefore, for theirs is nothing covered, and that shall not be revealed and hid, that shall not be known. When I tell you in darkness, you go speak in light. When you hear in the ear that I say, preach ye upon the hilltops. Fear not them which can kill your body, but are not able to kill the soul. But rather fear them that are able to destroy both soul and body in hell. What's he talking about? Bottom line, he's saying about himself and his Talmidim here. Bottom line, if they're going to come after me, if they think that my insurrection, Yeshua would be saying, is so bad, so wicked, so evil, well, they're going to say the same thing about you too. Well, we got to be smarter than that. We got to go after them. Don't worry. Don't be afraid for your lives. This is the same thing that the Viet Cong were taught. This is the same thing Al-Qaeda is taught. This is the same thing the Taliban was taught. This is the same things the kamikaze pilots were taught. Don't worry about your lives in this world. Worry about your soul. That's the same mentality that has always motivated and inspired zealots. If they had explosives in those days, which we know they didn't, Yeshua's followers would have been suicide bombers. That is the actual history. I know that does not fit in with the Christian mythology of pacifism. But go look into the reality of things as we're seeing. And I don't think this is too far-fetched to see. So then he continues with his pitch in faith. Are not two sparrows sold for a farthing, and one of them shall not fall to the ground without your father? The very hairs of your head are all numbered, yada, yada, yada. I want to jump because we're running out of time. Listen carefully. Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I come not to send peace, but a sword. I have come to set a man at variance against his father and daughter against the mother and daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's foes shall be those of his own household. And he that loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He that loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. He that taketh up... Oh, hold on a second. Okay, I'll get to the cross thing in a second. Christians love to interpret this symbolically. But in light of everything we've been seeing, the Sicarii was a sword. Remember Yeshua said, bring my enemies before me and I'm killed? You see here the whole preparation for the war? His own words say it! That is not meant to be taken in some fantasiacal, symbolic interpretation. He's speaking literal. I am here to create a war. A physical war. A bloody war. I am going to bring the monarchy back. We are going to overthrow the Romans. That's exactly how it was understood. That's exactly what his words meant. Now listen to this. And he that taketh not his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. Oh, that means we're supposed to sacrifice ourselves for the sin of mankind? Really? No! How many Jews were crucified by Rome? The answer? Thousands. The crucifixion was the cross was a Jewish sign of martyrdom. To wear a cross in those days would have meant similar to, if you will, wearing a yellow Jewish star from Auschwitz. It was a sign of sacrifice. So he's saying here, if you're not willing to die for treason, you're not worthy of this army. You have to be so gung-ho, so full of faith, that you are going to press the military issue. That is what he is saying. He that finds his life shall lose it. He that loses his life for my sake shall find it. He is calling for suicide. He is calling for sacrificers. That's what he wants. Maybe that is why he's looking for all these people with faith. That they have such absolute faith in him that they would commit any kind of atrocity in his name, like the Birionim. These were the Zealots. These were the Sicarii. These were the original historical followers of Yeshu. This was his, in quote, good news. This was the message of his kingdom. Not some pie-in-the-eye place in heaven, but the reestablishment of the monarchy here on earth. We ran out of time. All right. God be willing, we'll pick up a couple last verses here in chapter 10, and then moving right along with these things. But I hope that you see the subtle nuances here, which, in all due respect, are not so subtle. I know the Christian has an agenda to see things the way that their faith, their beliefs tell them. That's their myth. That's their belief. But when they come to ask us, why don't we see what they see? This is our answer. Here's the history, here are the facts, backed up by plenty of Christian scholarship that also knows and sees these things. Thank you again all for joining me in this class. I'm your host, Ariel Bar-Tzedok. Thank you all for your continuing support of KosherTorah.com. Hope to see you all online at KosherTorah.com soon. Thank you again all. Good night. God bless. Shalom.